is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Viewpoint This Sunday. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, filling in for the great Malcolm Out Loud. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be here with you all. This is a week of unbelievable activity going on. I think it's important that we really dig into some of these actions that we're seeing both home domestically and around the world, because it's going to affect all of us in the coming days and weeks. Now, normally when we cover top stories, we're covering, at least for a while, some of the nonsense that's been going on in Washington. We're seeing this absurd impeachment thing that goes round and round and round, where there's no real charges. It's a political game that's being played on all of us. And I think what we're seeing now is the hard reality of life in this past couple of days has now jumped up to slap us all in the face. And I'm certainly hoping that this wakes everybody up when we see what's going on over in Iraq and the potential huge conflict with Iran, the potential for war, the potential for more American troops being involved in another conflict. We're seeing the potential for terrorist attacks on America's allies, as well as our own interests in that region and in other places. You know, are there sleeper cells of Iranians here in the United States? All of these things are going to play out in the next couple of days and weeks. And I think this is probably the biggest wake-up call that all of us should pay attention. You know, the foolishness that's going on with this impeachment nonsense in our government right now is distracting us from the rest of the world. We have talked about this before. Is this impeachment situation, does this cause a problem for President Trump to try and do his job? Now, it's bad enough when it affects domestic things that are going on. He's trying to push his agenda. But now we're seeing a potential world event going on. And is that going to impede him from being able to do his job? So as we move forward, we have a lot of these questions we have to ask. You know, will there be that potential war in the region? Is Iran going to step up and do something we don't expect? Or are they just going to run their mouths and then back off? What happens here with the Russians and the Chinese? Is this an opportunity for them to see, hey, America's otherwise engaged, and do they step in? They were just over in that region doing military exercises together. So with me today is the great Jim McKay, and I want to let you know Jim is a political analyst. He's a radio producer with a background of over 30 years in global technology and communications, and Jim is with us today to kind of walk through some of these top stories. The embassy attack, troops getting sent over to that area, is it too little, is it too late, is it enough, and where we're going to go after the death of this General Soleimani from Iran. So, Jim, welcome aboard.
Good morning.
Let's look at the events at the embassy, because I think for a lot of people to understand, you know, what's going on over there, we have to look at this like a three-legged stool. All right. And I think that's what we're going to try and do today on Viewpoint This Sunday, is to try and sort this out, because we have the historical situation with Iran. We have the present day activities that are going on. And then we have to look down the road and say, what's coming tomorrow? And like I said, the coming weeks and months, where does this go? Is this a genie that can be put back in the bottle? Or is this something we're going to have to deal with sooner rather than later? So, Jim, this whole embassy, when the troops, the Iranian backed troops, who were they that were going up to the embassy? Were they, you know, the media told us they were just angry Iraqi citizens who didn't like what was going on. Who were they?
These were actually people that are part of this militia groups that are throughout a lot of Iraq. They are people that are aligned with the Shias out of Iran. The Soleimani guy, he kind of controls and has overseen that militia activity during the 10, 15 years that we've been in the region fighting. He is a linchpin, well, he's a dead linchpin now, of this entire activity. So these people were not just, you know, a bunch of kids that had nothing to do on a Wednesday afternoon, and we're going to go down and we're going to protest as the year is starting off. It had the strangest feeling when I watched that, and later I watched a newsreel of the 79 attack on the U.S. Embassy in Tehran when they took that over. And especially when you got down to the helicopters coming in with, well, at this time we had helicopters coming in with Marines and not backing off and taking embassy personnel out. But it had this really strange feeling. And again, when they stormed the embassy a few years ago in Cairo, in Egypt, had that same, you know, whoa, what is happening here? Who are these people? They're supposed to be allies.
Right. And we look at, you know, these attacks on these embassies. I remember 1979. I remember I was a much younger person at the time, but I remember an attack on an American embassy just seemed like such a strange thing. And then to see the people in the streets storm the gates, go in and then take the diplomatic personnel in there hostage. And we all know they held them for 444 days. It was a huge problem for America. We were trying to figure out how do we respond to this, which is really the modern resurgence of this battle between the West and Islam. You know, I don't want to say it's against the entire religion because it's not. But the reality is there are people who use maybe that religion to push their own agenda and to control their people. But that was one of the first major incidents where we had this clash of cultures that I remember. It was shocking to me that this had taken place. But now attacks on embassies seem like it's a regular part of what goes on. We look at Benghazi and, you know, the whole talk about the left-wing media talking about, oh, this is Trump's Benghazi, is absurd, because if you look at how the two were handled, there's nothing similar whatsoever, as you were saying. But the attack on the compound in Benghazi was the same thing. Our people are out there, and they're not always well protected. And this seems to be a point of vulnerability for us that leads us to have to take these responses. So looking at these embassies going forward, I think we got to fortify all of them around the world. There should be huge deployments to each and every one of those places. What do you think?
Definitely. First of all, I think we have too many diplomats in too many places that they don't belong there. We can get by with a lot fewer personnel than we have. We create dangerous situations doing that. The embassy protection, I mean, Benghazi, that was a travesty. They kept asking for more people, more protection, and the heads of the State Department refused them. In fact, because they didn't want to insult the local administration by putting more of U.S. military presence on the sites. You know, diplomacy is something we don't do well on an international footing. I think we're a very naive people. We trust people too much. The cultural differences between the East and the West have been going on for thousands of years. Islam is not just a religion. It is a culture. It is a government. It is a dynasty that goes back to, well, as Islam in Persia is what we're talking about, goes back over 1,000 years. The Arabs invaded what was then Persia in 760 AD, I think, somewhere around there. And by 1000, it was an Islamic culture. It is embedded. I mean, the supreme leader is a religious person. He is not a secular president. I mean, they have a president in name only, but he doesn't pull the strings. He doesn't make the final decisions. You can't separate the two.
Right. And when I look at that historically, because I think you have to have historical background to understand where all this is coming from. And that's why we mentioned 1979, is that I guess in historical past, the East and the West really did not come to blows because the West was so powerful. You know, we had the empires that ruled all over the Middle East. And slowly and surely, as we got out and the world modernized, now the peoples of those regions, now they had more modern warfare. More equipment. They had weapons that they could fight back with, to the point that today we know that there are some areas that are now equipped with nuclear weapons, or they're trying very hard to obtain nuclear weapons. And that kind of changes the balance of power, where maybe we overran them in the past and could control that region much easier. Now it's not so easy. Now they can fight back, and that's obviously what all of this eggshell walking is all about. I want to get back to your comment, though. I find it very interesting when you say we have too many diplomats and how we look at this diplomacy. I think our problem is really, it comes from our own American people, the way we've come to see the world. We don't act from a position of strength. We're always apologizing for ourselves. At least we did that for many years under other administrations. And we started to take a back seat that we're too big, we're too powerful, we shouldn't do this. And the rest of the world really does not work on that principle. You know, the rest of the world is not America. You don't apologize for yourself. You don't keep backing down. You don't bow to these foreign leaders. What you do is you act from a position of strength. And from that position of strength, you handle your diplomacy. You know, we are not a nation that's going to go out and take over and take people's land and take their stuff, so to speak. But we are the most powerful nation in the world, and we should be respected for that. And because we back off all the time, I think that hurts us when it comes to the reality of the rest of the world. We're expecting everybody to be nice, and we have an entire political contingent in our country that expects us to back down and stop and don't be strong. And do you see that as a problem for us being seen by the rest of the world? Does that lead to this kind of violence?
I think greatly so. I mean, we have everybody says, why, if we're such a bad country, why does everybody want to come here? We're the envy of the world, but nobody wants to say that on the media. They would rather say that we are the root of all evil and we should let everybody in because we're the richest nation in the world. Well, those are two conflicting statements. I mean, we try to, for years, to export our culture around the world. In Vietnam, you couldn't have two Chevrolets in the driveway and a house in an air conditioning and everything in Vietnam. It wasn't going to happen, but that was our thinking at that time. American culture had to be the dominant culture in the world, and it just isn't so. I mean, you cannot modernize and social engineer in Afghanistan into being a American culture, nor can you do it in Iran, or could you do it in Iraq. Yet our diplomatic organizations are still based in that kind of thinking that, America, we're here to help you. And, you know, it's like Reagan said, the most dangerous words in the vocabulary, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. Well, that's the same thing we're looked at on the international scene. When we go into a country with hundreds and hundreds of diplomats and we start trying to re-engineer their government and re-engineer and change things, forget it. It doesn't work.
And I think what I see in that is, I understand the feeling here in America. We have freedom, we have liberty, and we see how that combined with our capitalist system has turned us not only into the most powerful nation that the world has ever seen, but we're also the richest. We have a standard of living here that is unbelievable. Even for people at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, while it is tough for many people, we still have greater standards and ability to help those people than they do anywhere else in the world. When you look at the wages in some countries where they're making 20 cents a day, they don't have the infrastructure that we have. I think it's a common sense kind of a thought that, hey, if we go there, they would want this too, wouldn't they? Wouldn't they want this kind of freedom? Wouldn't they want this kind of lifestyle? And I think we kind of miss out on the fact that, again, not every place is America. Different cultures see the world differently. They value things differently than we do, where we see this freedom, this liberty, this, you know, this prosperity that's booming all over the place, as that's got to be the be-all and end-all of human existence. Otherwise, you're falling behind. So we're going to bring that to you. And I think we've seen that fail in other places, because not that they don't want self-determination or whatever, but they don't necessarily want our lifestyle. And it's hard for people to get that through their heads. Why wouldn't you want to have a nice Cape Cod house with indoor plumbing and all the the essentials of life, as opposed to living less than that somewhere? And I think that's hard for us to get over that.
And that gets back to the fundamentalism and differences between Eastern and Western culture. I mean, the United States was the first true democracy since Athens in the world, thousands of years it took. We still had kings and queens and rulers all across Europe. You had fiefdoms and dukedoms and all this stuff, and people were still servants and slaves all over the place. And today you have Islam, which is about as far of a departure from our culture as there can be. Most of the Western world has a division or separation between church and state. Yeah, sure, England has the Church of England, but it's not mandatory. You don't have to belong, and excuse me, you don't lose your head if you decide to go off and practice some other religion. But Islam is so fundamentally ingrained into the day-to-day culture of those countries that you cannot have a separation between church and state and be an Islamic nation.
Right. And I guess what's probably missing there is because, I'm not a member of the Islamic religion. I am looking from the outside in. And I'm trying to understand it. I know people who are Muslim and they're wonderful people. And I understand that. I get the whole thing that, it's not a religion that's doing this. You hear all the things about the writings in their religious texts, and it tells them to do all of these things. And then you speak to people who are Muslim and they say, well, that's really hyperbole. That's really not exactly what we're supposed to do. But then you see these governments that actually go out and do these things as though that's real. And that's, I think, part of the confusion for most Americans is that we're trying to figure this out. We want to accept everybody. This is a place of free religion in America, but we don't understand when they go in and take people and cut their heads off. And like, what is that all about? How do you deal with that kind of a situation? And we're trying to put this all together. And when we see these things in the world that are not part of our culture, how do we work with that? I think we want to. We're enlightened enough to know, how do we get along? But it's hard to get along when people won't talk, won't engage you in a way that is productive, is dangerous. So I think that's part of this entire problem we're having, and it's coming to a head now. We're seeing that coming to a head now with for the last 30, 40 years it's been building. This attack on the embassy really kind of pointed out that something was starting to happen. The whole Iraq-Iran thing, people also don't understand that. I mean, Iran has been trying to take over Iraq. They had a 10-year-long war where thousands and thousands of their people were killed. And then the war's over and we removed Saddam. And now Iran is trying to have the main influence in that part of the world. They're trying to build, I guess, their own caliphate type of a thing over there, which is part of what's going on in the background that I don't know that everyone really understands, how they're trying to control that entire area. They're working towards nuclear weapons. We have a definite concern that they will attack Israel. They've been saying forever and ever and ever that they want to wipe Israel off the map, kill the great Satan, which is the United States, and the little Satan, which is Israel. So they've been saying they're at war with us. We have just kind of drifted in the background. They do small things. We see these terror attacks. How many American soldiers have been killed by this General Soleimani because of his plans, his plots? And now it comes to the fore, and we have a president who is not one of these apologists, who's looking at America as a place of strength. We build peace through our strength, and we have President Trump now who's not as the same as they've been in the past, or at least recent past. So he sent initially 700 Marines over to the embassy. And I don't know if you saw the video of that, but seeing those aircraft arrive on the roof of the embassy and seeing all those servicemen come piling out of those vehicles was a great feeling. I felt the relief. I can imagine how it felt to be in that embassy. Did you see that video?
Yes, it was very dramatic. And as I said earlier, it was nice seeing him coming in instead of going out to defend it, instead of bailing out and burning all the records and burning the embassy on our way out of Vietnam in 75. But very different president today than we've had outside of Reagan had the same message when he told Gorbachev at the time, take down the wall, and stood up to him at, I think it was Helsinki, when they had meetings there, and he told him, you're either going to sign the treaty or not, and on the SALT, and we wound up with the SALT agreements out of that. But it's as more things seem to change in the world, the more they seem to remain the same. And politicians, the supreme leadership from 79, when the Ayatollah Khomeini came back and took over after he'd been exiled for a number of years, the religious vigor within Iran is the linchpin to this whole thing. It's key. They don't have an economy that employs 97% of the people that like we do. I mean, we have, 3% unemployment. It's crazy. Over there, it's probably like 25 or 30% unemployment. And the people that are working, I guess they have a defense industry and other things going on. Iran is not a backwards country for the main part.
No, they were a modern place until they were revolutionized
cultural revolution.
Government. And I think I think your point is exactly right. The way the more the world changes, the more it's the same. Strength through leadership is what commands people's attention, and we now have a president who's doing that. So, Jim, this topic is something we're gonna go through much deeper today here on Viewpoint this Sunday, because, like I said, this isn't over. In the days and weeks to come, we're going to see a lot of things that are going to affect us all personally. So I want to thank you for being on and getting us started here with these top stories. We'll be back in a minute to continue our conversation here.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue: Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
Welcome back to Viewpoint this Sunday. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and we're going to continue this conversation. Like I said, this world incidents that are going on right now with the attack on the American embassy, the rising of Iran as a real negative player on the scene right now, a potential war that could be coming up. They're always threatening, but now we've done something very serious. We see our own domestic people here, our own politicians at home, depending on which side of the aisle you're on, either saying that the removal of this General Soleimani was either a good thing or a foolish move, and we need to really get a better understanding of all of that, because whatever's happening, the things are now set in motion. Whatever's going to happen down the road tomorrow, next week, next couple of months, is now in play. All of this is starting to happen, and I think we need to really take a look at what potentiality we all have here. So to do that, with me this morning, we have Mr. Dennis Santiago. Dennis is an American strategist focusing on asymmetric warfare, arms control, and global stability. Dennis's voice is a necessary voice in this situation because he has perspective that can help bring this all together. Also with us this morning is Alana Friedman. She is a veteran intelligence analyst, a political commentator, and host of the Friedman Report. Ilana brings to the table perspectives that can also help clear up some of the things that are going on to give all the rest of us an understanding of, hey, what our future could be like. So I'd like to welcome you all to Viewpoint this Sunday. Dennis, let's get a look here. Let's talk right immediately about who is this General Soleimani and what is this Quds force that he runs, and why is this important for us to know in America?
General Soleimani is probably the most evil genius that has been on this planet for quite some time. This is, for people who are unfamiliar with the man's history, he is the architect and the mastermind of what is called the Shia Crescent, which is Iran's dreams of dominating the northern Middle East. For people that don't further understand it, he was the guy that planned Benghazi. So the attack on the embassy and the death of Ambassador Chris Steele. The guy is probably responsible for maybe somewhere on the order of 100,000 people dying on this planet. And he ruled with an iron hand. His big thing in Iraq was the control and coordination of the Shia militias, which are a force of about 100,000 fighters in Syria that have been essentially, in the aftermath of ISIS, the bane of what is called the Nineveh Plain, the vast plain that extends from Iran all the way to Syria.
I think this is part of what gets people confused, is to understand you have Iran, you have Iraq, you have Syria. When you're talking about this expanse of land, it seems pretty clear that the Iranians for years now have been trying to take control of that area and make it like a super country where they would take that all over. Is that the idea? Is that one of their goals?
Yes, the Shia Crescent, just to make sure people understand. Soleimani designed this thing called the Shia Crescent. It goes from Yemen, which is why you hear stories in news occasionally about the attacks going on between, because Yemen borders Saudi Arabia. And extends from Yemen, coming up north through Iran, east through Iraq, west through Iraq, continuing west through Lebanon, Syria, with the goal of reaching of the Mediterranean, and from there, essentially dominating the area, basically north of Egypt all the way to south of Turkey.
All right, so that's
a vast area. Very
vast area. It gives us a pretty good picture. So I think that kind of clears up that a little bit. Is that that's why the ambitions of the Iranians are never ending, and that's where they're moving through. Now, Ilana, when I look at this and I say their historical perspective is since 1979, they've attacked our embassies, and they're growing. As Dennis points out, how they're trying to take over this area. What do you see as some of the obvious signs that we should have all been paying attention to, maybe? That are now being revealed by what's happening today?
Things I've been talking about for quite a long time has been the fact that the Shia leadership in Iran, which is largely Shia, but Shia actually represents a small portion of the population of Muslims in the world. Nevertheless, they have major, huge ambitions to take over the Muslim world, and become, in fact, what would be the caliph for the entire Muslim population. And at that point, I guess they expect all Muslims to become Shia and accept their theological point of view. And in the process of doing this, they don't really care who gets destroyed in the process. We've seen that the death toll in Syria under this kind of really toxic leadership has been something in the neighborhood of 500,000 people since 2011. And that has been something that they bragged about. And in fact, the new leader, the man who has taken the place of the Soleimani, bragged about the fact that because they were in Syria, they prevented a much larger massacre. And that's ridiculous, of course, because the massacre, 500,000 people, is already beyond understanding. So what they're trying to do, to answer your question, is to create a caliphate that would eventually encompass the entire world and make the entire world's population Shia Muslim.
It's something that doesn't really live in our everyday lives here in America. We don't really see it. We hear the news, but to realize this is all going on in the background, and it's never ending. We've been seeing this, how many wars over there we've been involved in, other people been involved in. You know, when I look at this and I see this General Salome, and I guess the question right now to clear this up, Dennis, when you're saying he's the mastermind of all of this, I know I read your article, and I'm going to tell everybody, go to the AmericaOutloud.com platform and read the article there by Dennis and read the article there by Ilana. Absolutely tremendous. Gives you a lot of understanding of what it is that's going on. It clears up a lot of things, and they both ask and answer great questions about this. It's going to help us all through this. This Soleimani guy is responsible for the deaths of how many Americans already up to this point? We don't even really know this guy. We hear his name, and now there's this argument here in America that we shouldn't have attacked him, we shouldn't have killed him. Because he's a government official, it sounds like they're saying, well, he's not an actual terrorist, which the president could have went and got. But it seems to me he's got more American blood on his hand than almost anybody else on the planet right now. And why didn't we take him out sooner? Dennis?
Well, we've been trying to. Up until very recently, we were not legally able to. In terms of how many, if you talk to veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars, you know, people that served tours of duty over there, they have very hard feelings towards Soleimani. Because I think the estimate is somewhere around 600 American service members have died as a direct result of the activities directed by Soleimani. He was the one that encouraged the Shia militias to attack Americans and quite viciously during the U.S. phase of the war in Iraq. He directed them to play a very large role in the fight against ISIS, and which basically put both the Kurds and the Iraqi government on basically having to work with them but be uncomfortable with them throughout the entire ISIS war. He is responsible for the funding that goes to Hamas, to and all of the rockets that rain down on Israel. That's him. He's the money behind that. The cruise missiles attacking Saudi Arabia oil facilities from Yemen, from Houthi bases. That was Soleimani. This guy was everywhere in the Middle East. And as a point, you know, this Shia Sunni war has been going on since the 7th century. It's this thing started. When this thing started, Rome was the empire dominant on this planet, and they are still around today. And they have dragged us in to their battle between each other over a religious philosophy.
Now, that's something that interesting in our first segment today, when I was talking with Jim McKay, we were talking about this clash of cultures. You know, we've heard that in media reports, you know, clash of cultures, East versus West. You don't really understand it until you get this historical perspective, because this is not part of everyday Americans' lives. We see news reports, we see the pictures, but you're right. This has been going on for centuries. Where is this leading us to? That tells me, first of all, that if this has been going on for centuries, unless there is a definitive end to this, it's going to go on for centuries to come. Ilana, do you see this as a bigger picture than our lifetime? Is this am I right in my assumption there that this is going to continue unless there's some kind of a serious end to this?
There are two perspectives on this. The first perspective is theirs. They believe that their Messiah is coming in the form of what they call the Mahdi, and that a period of chaos will take place before he comes. Now, they also seem to believe that they can create chaos. If they can create chaos, then he will come sooner. And in fact, they were so convinced when Ahmadinejad was president of, was actually mayor of Tehran, he widened the main street so that when the Mahdi came, there would be room for the procession. It's all bizarre from our point of view, but from their point of view, if they create the chaos, the Mahdi will come. And so that will be their end game. But from our point of view, from a Western point of view, they seem to be eager to start something. And honestly, an attack on the embassy of another country is an act of war, because you're actually attacking, in this case, America on American soil. That's an embassy is actually the soil of the country that it represents. So this was an act of war, and they instigated it. And it seems to me that they are trying to create the chaos that will bring in their minds the Mahdi. And in our case, it's likely to start a third world war. So when they attacked the embassy, that was the act of war that could start. It wasn't the killing of Soleimani, because that was something else. That was in response to an act of war. And I think it was justified. So we're talking about the unknown here, because we don't know what they're going to do. And they are the instigators, not us.
That's what you're saying? Their actions are going to cause us to take another action?
We did not start this war. And certainly since President Trump has been in office, he has shown enormous restraint. When they took our drone out of the sky, when they threatened our ships, we did not respond. In fact, the president actually called back a sortie by our planes rather than to create a situation that could destabilize the area, even though they had taken out our drone. So I think the president has shown enormous restraint, and now he's showing them this is the closed fist that he has been holding back, and now he is not holding back anymore, because it's justified to stop them from doing whatever they plan to do next.
Okay, well, at this point, I think we've cleared up the fact that Soleimani, no matter who he was a terrorist that had American blood on his hands, and he has now paid the price. And we've had a president who has served him some justice. Now, when I look at this and I'm saying, it seems to me, from what both of you were saying, and reading your articles on the platform is great, help me to gain a little bit of understanding here. It seems the Iranians are trying to goad us into this activity. They're shooting down our drones. You know, it's kind of like smacking the lion with a stick. You know, what do you expect that lion to do eventually? Just keep turning away? So you're trying to goad the United States into some type of action. And my question is, well, why would they want to do that? There is no way they could defeat us in a conflict. I mean, our military would remove them from the planet in short order. So what's the purpose of goading them? But when, Ilana, you bring up that they're expecting this religious savior to show up if there's this conflict, it seems to me that that's built in to their world a little more than it is. You know, the United States, we've lost a lot of our religious underpinning, and they're living it more there where it's real for them. If they make this happen, you know, their Mahdi's going to show up, and I guess that'll change the world. Who does that benefit for them to go to? Is that really what this is about, you think, Dennis?
Yeah, that's part of it. From the if you look at it from the where the Ayatollahs and the religious leadership of Iran come from, they've always had this dream, and you know the Sunnis have had their own dream of a caliphate as well, and you know, and in its strangest expression in recent times, and it has been weirder. I mean, this is not the weirdest time in the history of this conflict. Was the rise of ISIS, which was a Sunni led caliphate, but on a more practical sense, one of the things that Iranians are doing is, you know, they have a very weak regime and their economy is in a shambles and their people are very, very unhappy. They demonstrate quite a lot in very large demonstrations all the way across the country in Iran. And they hide it from us by basically what they do is they shut down the internet so that not very much gets out. So you only see tiny snippets and stuff here and there. And you have to watch publications like Al Jazeera and not the U.S. mainstream media to see the coverage of it.
Where do we go from here, I guess, is the next question. The next couple of days and weeks and months, we're going to see activities take place. And I would like to ask both of you to stay for one more segment, because we're not done with this. This topic is really just getting started. So we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with some more Viewpoint this Sunday.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to this, I think, is an extraordinary version of The Viewpoint This Sunday. As your host, I also host a show on the network called Chasing Justice, and I wanted to mention that last week, and I forgot, so I want to jump that out there. If you can listen to me, we'd love to have you. We're at 3 p.m. every day here on AmericaOutloud.com. But my two guests here, Dennis Santiago and Ilana Friedman, we are knee-deep into this at this point. There's concerns. People out there are concerned that the events in Iran can lead to a third world war. I think we have to look a little closer at the participants. And Ilana, like you said, it's whatever Iran is going to do. Now, I know they have some serious problems at home, and I know the people have tried to revolt against the mullahs and take their country back, so to speak. And that hasn't happened. Economically, they must be suffering under these sanctions. What can you tell us about what's going on inside there?
Well, it's very interesting. When Donald Trump put sanctions on Iran 2 years ago, that's when the sanctions started, and then they got more and more severe. Even Soleimani had a sanction on him. What happened was that Iran lost some 90% of their oil-producing capability. And that 90% represents most of the income. The whole economy was based on its oil production and the sale of its oil. So when they lost that, they began to suffer from economic disaster at home. The prices skyrocketed, everything, even the most necessary items skyrocketed, so that they became unaffordable to many of the Iranian people. And several months ago, an uprising began in Iran that the government could not put down. In one city, the men in the city blocked the streets in order to keep the government out. And when the local police couldn't do anything about it, they sent in the IRGC. And within 3 days, they had killed some 150 men in the city. Just shot them right down, just in cold blood. And this is the way they keep order. But the people in Iran are really suffering. And these demonstrations began when the government raised the price of gasoline by 50% overnight. And this was just more than the people could handle. They were already having problems with it, not being able to afford necessities. And as a result, this is a story that we're not getting. In some cases, the government has actually shut down the internet on phones and computers so that the people in Iran could not communicate with each other or with the outside world. So a lot of this information is just not getting out. Right. But we do have a situation. The question is now, what will Iran do? What are their priorities? And it looks like their priorities are to create the chaos that will bring the caliphate over taking care of their own people who are in desperate straits.
So when we look at situations like that, you know, how long can a government keep the lid on things like that? We see in Venezuela when people are eating their cats and dogs. We see people rioting, and then the government comes in, and basically you're going to fight a gun when you're unarmed, and that quells the people. So, Dennis, what you were saying earlier is that this Soleimani was also the strong hand to keep down the Iranian people when they would rise up, and Ilana telling us that he's going in and, you know, they're gunning down their own people. That is a very powerful weapon to keep people at bay. How long does that stay? How long does the lid stay on this before the people of Iran rise up? And we could have helped them at one point, and we didn't. How long until that boils over, do you think?
Oh, I think we just helped them. I think the death of Qasem Soleimani changes everything in the Middle East. The man was a mastermind. This is, you know, Osama bin Laden, Baghdadi, were amateurs compared to this guy. If you really want to compare how evil this man was, you have to go back to people like Heinrich Himmler and his vision of dominating the planet. Okay? This is how bad this guy was. Subjugating everyone on Earth is something that was well within his capability to do. And I think we just helped the Iranian people by getting rid of him, as we just helped the Iraqi people by getting rid of him, as we just helped the Syrians, as we just helped the Israelis, as we've helped the Libyans.
You know, it's
everybody. Donald Trump perceived something going on here. Okay, Soleimani was flitting back and forth across the Middle East. He was in Lebanon, he was in Syria, and he was on his way to Iraq. What he was doing, I believe, was preparing to launch a spring campaign with all the forces that he had to take pressure off of the Iranians at home by starting things in other areas to occupy the United States and its allies in turmoil, by organizing the militias in Iraq and in Syria and anywhere else that he could get, so that we would be facing a spring of 2020 of chaos, exactly of the type that Ilana was talking about. And he intercepted that.
So you're saying, right? President Trump must have had some kind of information that saw this is the moment to get rid of this guy before this happens. Is that what you're saying?
If you watch the artifacts of things, you know, Donald Trump tweets, right? And people put him down for his tweets. But if you look at what he says, all right? You know, what did the man say in the aftermath of this? It was not my intent to force regime change in Iran. That's up to the Iranian people.
That's a message to them.
It was my intent to stop a war from happening, not to start one, to stop one. All right. Soleimani was a mastermind. I mean, the guy was good. This was Dr. Evil.
So okay, now, let's look at that for a second. Let me take that apart for a second. I had said earlier, you know, this Soleimani is off the scene now. The picture you're painting of him is this, really this mastermind of what, whatever information President Trump had, that their war was coming, this chaos for the spring was probably coming, which would have it could have changed our economic situation, could have done a lot of things. He chose this moment to act. Does this death of Soleimani create a leadership void that we can exploit in Iran?
Because not just us.
Gone, where else? How does that help us?
Doesn't just help us, it helps everybody else. Okay. So this guy was very charismatic, by the way. People loved him. I mean, you know, if you watch Iranian TV right now, there are generals and public officials crying openly on the air because they loved this man. He was, you know, if you were on his side, he was a beloved figure. This guy was a messiah as far as they were concerned. All right. What we've done is we've made it so without him, the rest of the Iranian leadership, you know, they're kind of bush league. What does that do in the matrix of the Middle East? If you were a Shia, you got 100,000 Shia militia fighters in Iraq, right? You know, they followed Soleimani because he was the Pied Piper. With him gone, they're not going to have the same trust in Iranian leadership that they did before. So that throws the entire agenda of finding a way to take over the Iraqi government to extend the presence of Iran to the West into turmoil. Probably has cut off the dreams of the Shia Crescent to reach the Mediterranean for at least 100 years. Okay?
That is an amazing thing to say, that this one man being removed, first of all, it does two things. If that's the reality, that this one man was the linchpin for all of this, that it sets them back 100 years in their plan, it certainly emphasizes the decision by President Trump to take him out. The question I have, though, Ilana, let me ask you this based on all of this. We know in the past when we've had these tyrannical leaders and the world wants them gone. I think of, you know, the Soviet Union, how upset we were that they were, you know, the Iron Curtain for the world. We got to get rid of them. And it fell apart. The Soviet Union dissipated. And everybody, this is great. The world's going to be great now. And unfortunately, it unleashed problems all over the place that even though they were bad, they kept under control. Is that something we may see here now with the death of Soleimani, who was the ringleader of this? do we see chaos popping up in other places? Now, someone else wants to be the leader of the caliphate, and they start some nonsense. What do you see there?
Well, first of all, the supreme leader, the Ayatollah, appointed the deputy commander of the Quds Force, a guy by the name of Brigadier General Esmail Ghani. Ghani, I guess it's hard to pronounce in English. And he was the deputy commander, and he is now the commander. And the interesting thing is that he is not Soleimani. He was in charge of the finances for the IRGC. And this is going to be a smooth turnover, but I don't think we are going to see another Soleimani rise from this man. Because he's an accountant, essentially, compared to the mastermind that Soleimani was. We're going to be facing something different, and we don't know what it is. It may be that they will appoint someone else to complement him. Don't know. We just don't know what's going to happen. So it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen next, since we don't know how this guy is going to behave, and we don't know how competent he's going to be. And that puts some pressure on our side, because we're going to have to prepare for an awful lot of things that we don't really know what they are. And we don't know how effective they're going to be, because we don't know how good this guy is going to be at the helm of the IRGC.
Right. So if I go back to my question then that I had asked Dennis, how do we exploit this?
Well, I think we can exploit it by understanding that this guy is not Soleimani, and he is not going to be able to have the competence and the brilliance of strategic planning and operations that Soleimani had. It may give us an advantage. I think it should give us an advantage in the future, but since we don't know what we're dealing with, it's not clear how we should prepare. I think what the president has done, sending over several thousands of our troops into the region, is going to make a difference, because in the Middle East, a show of strength is what is most respected, and it is what protects us from the start of a third world war. I think the president is on the right track. As long as the deployment of these troops does not trigger a war, I don't think it will, because I think it will put the fear of God into the Iranians to some extent. And they're going to feel the pressure. They have pressure from inside, from the demonstrations that are still going on all over the country. And they'll have the pressure from outside, from this show of force by the United States. I think that's a pretty good combination.
Well, I think that's an excellent analysis of that situation, because the reality is, as they start to fall apart, as you lose a leader, my concern, looking at human nature, would be if the riots in their own city, if people starting to revolt, they're going to feel a need to take some kind of an action to maybe get that off of people's minds. So, Dennis, I would ask you, what steps do we take as the United States? Let's watch them implode. That would be the best. Our troops are there. Ilana's point is great. That part of the world, and I think every part of the world, respects strength. What do we do if they attack one of our allies or our assets?
Well, we do the same thing that we have been doing for a while, because we have a strategy that has been working very, very well. It's a strategy of containment. Okay, surrounding Iran, the United States has been for some time building a very strong coalition of countries countries that in the past have not done very well at cooperating with each other, but are cooperating with each other now. You have Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. All right, these are countries that have come together: Jordan, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates. On one side, you have, in more of a dysfunctional family sense, you have the Turks on the north, and you have the Iraqis that are all there. We have been working very, very hard to make it so that the Iranian explosion doesn't get out of the sphere of Iran. I would very much suggest, you know, the United States is a country that leads not just from strength, but from a heart. Okay. And so while we have been containing the Iranians, and they have been attempting to get us to lose our cool, and we are not losing our cool because we are currently under an administration that knows how to be a cool cucumber, all right? But one of the things that we could do, we have strengthening relationships with the Russians and the Chinese. I mean, you know, Putin just thanked us for helping prevent a terrorist attack in Russia, all right? Through American intelligence. He thanked Donald Trump explicitly. All right, we're about to sign a trade deal that will help the Chinese prevent famine in their country. We have very good relations here. Of all the things that the United States could lead in, and I'm going to, because I want to be positive about this in terms of where the world could go that isn't down the toilet, is that the United States could lead everybody else to say, okay, the Iranians are going to collapse. When they do, our job is to make sure that the Iranian people have a better world in the aftermath of the end of the Shia nightmare. And if we can do that, we have a peaceful Middle East for another 100, 200, maybe 500 years. That is not a bad goal to have as a world leader.
So the bad actor in all of this, it seems, and when you're painting a picture that the countries in that region are, is it that they are modernizing? Is it that they are seeing benefits to coming into the modern world as opposed to making this caliphate? That the bad actor here is Iran, and they really are all tired of what they're doing and are willing to, you think they would all create a coalition to go after them if they were to start some type of a conflict and be on our side and beat them down, so to speak?
It may be more like a Marshall Plan when all is said and done, you know, restoring basic services and economic services. Iran has the potential to once again be, the second largest producer of oil on this planet. There are all kinds of things. Yeah, I mean, it's a very rich country in terms of resources. But one of the ways you can look at it is that are the values of the Western world going and the way that we like to run a community of nations around this planet that is based on the acceptance of plurality, which is the exact opposite of a monotheistic culture and monotheistic fanaticism that is this vision of a Shia caliphate or a Sunni caliphate or whatever it is. If we can get beyond that, a lot of these countries already have a lot of people that would rather live in this plural Western model that we have had for the rest of this planet for quite some time, and I don't see any reason why, as a world leader, we shouldn't be pushing for those better values.
That's excellent hope, and I'm glad you brought us to a place of hope here. I want to thank both of you for being on here on Viewpoint this Sunday. I think we've unpacked a lot of this stuff here, hopefully to give some of our listeners a little more understanding what's going on. Obviously, you were both very well versed in all of this. It is a very complicated situation. It does bode well for us if Iran were to fade away from internal actions. But I think having a strong president who has now created that red line and demonstrated he's willing to step over it, that can help with some leadership. I'm hoping that that's where we go with this. I guess we're going to see in the days and weeks to come, as I've said many times here today, the world is unfolding right before us, and we need to all pay attention. This is not something that can sit in the background anymore. All of our lives are dependent on how this goes from now and our into the future with our children. So, thank you for listening, everybody. It's been a pleasure to be here with you. I want to thank Dennis and Alana again for adding so much to this program. And remember, it's time to get involved, and it's time to get loud.